The standard formula for right mindfulness involves two activities. One is keeping focused on something, a body in and of itself, feelings, mind states, mental qualities in and of themselves, and then putting aside greed and distress with reverence for the world. This is basically a description of how you get into concentration. You bring three qualities of mind to these processes: mindfulness, keeping something in mind; alertness, watching what you're doing while you're doing it and seeing what results you're getting; and ardency, trying to do this well, basically right effort. In the largest suttas on mindfulness, the emphasis is on the first activity. What does it mean to keep the body in mind in and of itself? What does it mean to keep track of the body in and of itself, or the feelings, whatever? And because the sutta is so long, everyone assumes that that's a complete description of mindfulness. But it's not. It's only focused on one part of the formula. There's no explanation of what mindfulness means, what ardency means, what alertness means. Nothing about putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. So this is why we get the statements that mindfulness is open and accepting whatever comes up. Whereas in the Buddhist descriptions, it's not that way at all. Mindfulness has its boundaries. Think of the image of the quail. When it stays in its ancestral territory, i.e. a plowed field, it's safe. But when it goes outside of that territory, the hawk can catch it. And the area outside its territory stands for pleasures of the senses. You get involved in sensuality, you're putting yourself in danger. You've wandered away from your foundation of mindfulness. And sensuality is basically what greed and distress is all about. We're greedy for things in the world because of our sensuality. When we don't get what we want in terms of our sensuality, we get distressed. Back and forth like that, all because of sensuality. So it's good to think about what it means to put aside greed and distress, to put aside sensuality with reference to the world. First off, understand sensuality. It's not so much the pleasures of the senses, it's your fascination with thinking about them. Finding them, craving them. Then when you get them, either being satisfied with them and delighting in them, or not being satisfied and getting upset. And then when they're gone, you can either be thinking about how good they were when they were there, or how much you miss them. Of course, that makes you want to find them again. That's where we're really attached. And if you want to look for craving, where craving is focused, you look there in our fascination with imagining different forms of sensuality and playing with the various forms that we could imagine. So you look for the allure. Why is it that you like this? And you look for the drawbacks. The Buddha has lots and lots of ways of looking at the drawbacks. One is a series of analogies to take some of the glamour away from sensuality. Because there's that sense of glamour which is part of the allure. And we think that some of that glamour rubs off on us as we're thinking about these things. But the Buddha is basically saying, you're like a dog gnawing on a bone. That's not very glamorous. You're going around with borrowed goods, and the owners see you with their borrowed goods and they take them away. Whatever sensual pleasures you get, wherever you're getting them, they can be taken away. Some of the images, like the honey on a blade of a knife, admit that there is some pleasure to them, but they're dangerous. Others make them seem pretty empty entirely, like the dog gnawing on the bones. And some of them point out the dangers when you're fixated on a particular sensual object. Other people will be fixated on it too, and they want to take it away from you. Like the hawk, it's got a piece of meat, and other hawks and crows come attack it. And if it doesn't let go of the meat, it's going to die. So it's good to try to figure out where exactly is the allure. And sometimes it's in the object. That's when there's lust. You really lust somebody after somebody's body. This is why we have the contemplation of the 32 parts. You ask yourself, okay, which parts do you lust for? Can you have those parts without the other parts? What would that be like? If you lust for the skin, well, take the skin off. Would you want it then? No. So even though we focus very selectively on parts of the body and try to ignore the others, we realize that even the parts that we focus on would not be all that attractive if they didn't have the other more disgusting parts. Now we say this and somebody says, well, you're trying to give people a negative body image. Well, there's a healthy negative body image and there's an unhealthy negative body image. The unhealthy one is when you think other people have beautiful bodies, but you don't. The healthy one is when you realize everybody has all these unattractive parts in their bodies. We're all equal in this way. And as long as we lust after these things, we're putting ourselves in a position of danger, a position of fear. Two of the fears of death, as the Buddha enumerated them, comes down to fear of losing the body, fear of losing your sensual pleasures. And so by being attached to these things, we're putting ourselves in a dangerous position. So you want to look at them thoroughly. Are they really worth it? And then the question is that really where your craving is focused anyhow? Because a lot of times we think we desire an object, and it's not so much the object we desire, we have a perception about it. We're focused on the perception. We're focused on our self-image as it relates to that object, like the ugly, wealthy men who get trophy wives, hoping that some of their attractiveness will rub off on them. This plays a huge role, especially, you see this especially in advertisements. If you own X, you're going to look attractive. If you own X, other people are going to be jealous of you. That kind of thing. We see this in the Pali Canon. There's that famous story of the nun going through the forest, and she's accosted by a young man who's attracted to her. He tries to get her to disrobe. She fortunately is a non-returner, so she's not interested. Now in some translations of the story, he comes on as being really crude and unappealing. The implication being, well, if he's a little bit more sophisticated than he would, then she might have been interested. But the actual Pali text, some of the most sophisticated poetry in the whole canon, he's a real master of painting pictures. And the pictures he paints are not so much about sex itself, but of what she would become if she were to go with him. She would be like a golden doll. She would have all the clothes she could want. She would have people waiting on her. In other words, she's trying to appeal to her sense of herself as the pursuer of sensual objects and enjoying sensual objects. So he's basically trying to appeal to her sense of becoming, her craving to become something. It's pretty impossible. A golden doll. Who would want to be a golden doll? And she sees right through it. She asks him, well, what is there in this body that you're attracted to? And she goes around all the unattractive features of the human body. He says, your eyes. She says, what is there attractive about eyes? And she says, there's mucus in eyes and tears in eyes and just little globes. And here, if you want one, have one. She plucks it out. That scares him. He realizes what he's up against. He apologizes and leaves. She goes to see the Buddha and she gets her eye back. So he's hoping that he can snare her, not so much with the pleasures of sex, but with what she would become as an enjoyer of those things. He's hoping that that's where her craving might be focused. You see the same thing in a John Lee's fantasy. When he was a young monk, he was thinking of disrobing. So one night he decided to think it through. What would actually happen if he disrobed? And you read his fantasy. And if you know anything about Thai society, you realize how impossible his fantasy starts out. He gets a good job. He wants a wife. He decides here he is a peasant boy from the northeast, poorest part of the country, and he wants the daughter of a nobleman. And in his fantasy, he gets her. And there's one point where he says he wants to go home and show her off to his family and his relatives and his friends. In other words, it has little to do with her and a lot to do with what his friends would think of him if he had her as a wife. And then reality sets in. He realizes that he's going to have to force her to separate herself from her parents. They're going to disown her. She's going to have to work. She's delicately brought up. She's not going to be strong enough to do the work. She's going to die. She leaves behind a child. He gets a wet nurse to nurse the child. He ends up marrying her. Then they have a child. And then she starts playing favorites. His family life becomes a mess. He thinks to himself, if only I hadn't disrobed. Then realizes, oh, I still haven't disrobed. It's just a fantasy. But look at that, all the suffering he would put those people through. First the nobleman's daughter, then the other woman, and then the kids. All because of his desire to look cool in the eyes of his friends. So you can reflect on your fantasies and realize how empty they are and how much suffering they would entail if you really tried to follow through with them. It's one major step in putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. Now, as the Buddha says, if you don't have the pleasure of the first jhana or something better, then no matter how much you see the drawbacks of sensuality, you're still going to go back to it. This is why the purpose of mindfulness practice is to get the mind into concentration, so you can strengthen that focus away from sensuality. So you're not going to be a slave to your cravings, a slave to your fantasies. And this way, limiting the mind actually frees it. Instead of thinking about what you're missing as you're sitting here, you can think about what you're freed from. Appreciate the ability to find a sense of happiness that doesn't have all those drawbacks. Because we live in this world of sensuality. Look around us. War. People wanting war. People lying because they want war. That's the kind of world you have to live in if you're going to be pursuing your sensual passions, sensual fantasies. Is this really where you want to be? Isn't there something better?